today is the day of critics and writers, and maybe we can hope to get a more comprehensive view of our situation and our practice in postmodernism. May I invite Geeta for the first presentation of the morning.
I want to present a fairly exploratory paper. It's not a position that I can say is in any way defined, and possibly it may not always be easy to defend it either, but that is probably one of the purposes. I want to present it here for the response. I'm not showing any slides, so I will be reading and speaking from my notes here. I've called the presentation A Poetics of Displaced Objects, but this is not an illustration of particular objects that can be enlisted in order to prove a thesis. I'm going to put a series of propositions, where many of them interrogative propositions, before you. The first little part is called Dismantling the Norm. Despite the variety of well-appointed actors in the theatre of Indian art, there was, until recently, an aspiration that the artist becomes a centrally positioned national figure, that the artist should have the wherewithal to articulate in work and speech a historical position that clearly demarcates a hospitable national space. I think clearly Hussein belongs to that category of artist. I think if we were to name one artist, it is certainly Hussein, who positions himself in a way as to designate the national space as hospitable, no matter what the conditions, the circumstances which may have actually taken place, in particularly in the last decade, to make it inhospitable. He continues to function as if it were a hospitable space in which he must provide an integrated identity as an artist. This integrated identity had something to do with the mythic imaginary of lost communities, even as it had to do with post-independence nationalism and its political utopia. It had to do with third world anti-imperialism as well. The norm of such an identity was honorable. It does not always hold so well now. While cultural imperialism, dressed up in euphemistic phrases, is becoming the more globally rampant, our critical task is further situated, paradoxical as it may seem, in the framework of a national culture once again, but from the other end, as it were. And I would suggest that what is in urgent need of unmasking is the clean civilizational profile that cultural practitioners in India, artists among them, have hitherto adopted. There was an assumption articulated by artists, at any rate, not in civilizational terms, but certainly in terms of authenticity. And this authenticity conflated the existential and the political within it. And I would say that, for instance, the kind of position that Sudhir would take, or was taking yesterday, would belong to this mode self-identification, where you do not actually allude to a civilizational question, but you position yourself within the social on the claim of authenticity, whereby you can actually engage with the civilizational question itself. And in other arts, in cinema and literature, it might be even more obvious. For an artist, the questions are honed at the level of practice. The formal logic, the stylistic dovetailing, and the contending ideologies of modernism were never systematically investigated in the Indian art context, but they were often and successfully, sometimes fortuitous, sometimes passionate syncretism of contemporary Indian art could actually solve the problem as it had been faced in the post-independence period. I would suggest that this, what I'm calling sometimes fortuitous, sometimes passionate syncretism of contemporary Indian art was in fact a dynamic of its own. And I would quote very quickly, and these are very notational examples, this doesn't attempt to cover systematically the list of important artists who contributed to the making of contemporary art. I would suggest here, for instance, three very different positions could be considered. What I'm suggesting is the way modernism has been constructed in what I'm calling its more benign and syncretic aspects. It would be Tayyab Mehta, whose work you've seen yesterday, for those who are not already familiar with it. K.G. Subramaniam, Ghulam Sheikh, three very different artists who would have attempted this kind of a positioning. Now, all of a sudden, national protectionism in art, as in economics, has been dropped, and the vexed category of the Indian modern stands exposed. As thresholds open up in every direction around the Indian artist, there is, besides art historical retrospection, a spirited transgression as well. This includes welcome trip-ups on the correct application of both the realist and the modernist canon. That is where perhaps I would take issue with the mode of articulation that would be, for example, taken up in one line of an argument from Timothy to Give to Sudhir. I would place it as one part of our debate, but I would suggest that there are other parts of the debate which have to be added on to it in order to be able to comprehend the situation in which we have to develop a way of arguing about Indian art. It also includes what it needs to include, to my mind, is critical reckoning with post-colonial politics and global postmodernism. The politics of Indian art from the Place for People, which was 1981, an exhibition that many of you would be familiar with, which included Bhupen Khakkar, Ghulam Sheikh, Vivan Sundaram, Nalini Malani, Sudhir Patwardhan, Jogen Chaudhary, an important marker. Two, I would suggest the Radical Artists from Kerala, which is a movement which begins in 85, takes shape in 87, is in a sense goes into a somewhat of a wilderness in 89. That this phase is, to my mind, which is the phase of the 80s, basically, very important in actually having posed the question of how the realist stroke modernist canon. And whereas in the European situation or in the American situation, certainly the realist part of the paradigm would not even be in question, in India, as you could see yesterday from some of the discussions, it is in question. So one would say equally realist modernist as one might say modernist postmodernist in India. So we'd have a three-part equation at work. And I think that in the 80s, this three-part equation was put onto the stage and had to be worked out. And it is being worked out, obviously, till today. The devolution of identity in the Indian artist is a loss of a certain equation between history, sovereignty, and the subject. It is also the loss of a monadic self that is conceptually male. The gain is a centrifugal force wherein the artist pulls out fragments of otherness and clads the self but sparsely. And I would suggest that an artist like Bhupen Khakkar would be a prime example of having broken down with not at the level of, obviously, of intellection and discourse, but at the level of his practice, consistently for 30 years broken down the too deterministic relationship between India's modern history, its notions of sovereignty, and the subject. And that is why, in fact, I would suggest that the debate invariably need not go into the question of painting and non-painting. I think that there could be moves within painting which can be as radical as in any of the other forms, and therefore we should leave the question of painting and sculpture and installation and performance, dealing with them all at the same time rather than in separate categories. Is this then a no-norm artist, or is this a masquerading subject who is more often than not a mock surrealist with astonishing layers of interiority still immanent? We have to find ways of conceptualizing this oddly symbolic, variously displaced art practice, manifesting itself in the stark gestures of civilizational avatars dismantled. And the younger lot would take this on, I think, with a kind of a passion and even desperation, and also in some cases with great degree of equanimity. And I would like to suggest that an artist like Rimzen, or an artist like a sculptor like Rimzen, or a painter like Surendran, with whom you may not be so familiar, but hopefully you will be, or he has shown in Bombay actually not so long ago, are able to actually reinscribe themselves into a surrealist mode for purposes very different from the original surrealist mode, of course, and be able to actually present in this time, which is a time where interiority is almost entirely fudged or camouflaged, to be actually able to present the question of the symbolic in terms of an interior life. Like Duchamp's bride stripped bare by her bachelors even, what was that norm that needed to be dismantled in Indian art? There was a properly clad national modern norm. I would answer, but that it was by and large male, and it may be that it is being stripped bare by the brides even. And I think that Pushpa was trying to indicate that yesterday. And if you were to extend that argument, I think that would be, it could take directions other than that she was proposing in that limited presentation yesterday, but I think that is worth considering. And if you were to take artists as diverse as from Arpita to Nalini to Nilima, Navjot to Rekha Rudvitya, Pushpamala herself to Sheila Gowda to Rumana, I think that that is the kind of position they would take to the norm that I'm suggesting was in place, certainly since independence. Now, I want to, the second part of this little presentation is called the question of an Indian stroke Asian avant-garde, and there's a question mark after that, because I think that this is a question which is not yet fully resolved, even in terms of our art historical, art critical discourse, certainly not vis-a-vis what would be the long, for decades-long formulation on the question of the avant-garde in the Euro-American context. Every avant-garde is placed in a disjuncture. I'm suggesting, as very briefly just now, that we are placed now in that kind of a disjuncture, which is not only a political disjuncture and an economic one, but very clearly now to us a cultural and artistic one as well. We are certainly placed in a position where we cannot think of the past and the present and the future in some sort of a continuum. There were homogenizing values, including sovereignty, that were available within a national culture so defined. In India, moreover, there was a long enough tradition of the modern to produce its own canon. And I think it might even in the short glimpse yesterday have come through that we actually do have a debate in our own situation which can treat of an Indian modernism and take positions within it and go back and forth in it. And that already, of course, the moment we can make such a definition is already something of a canon. Two, there has been a great desire to see this canon defined as high culture in parity with the civilizational idea. I think that all canons in any case define themselves as high culture, but in our case we had the extra burden or privilege of a civilizational notion in parity of which this modernist canon had to be placed. So that almost ipso facto, there was almost a priori, the modernist canon had to have the civilizational span. Three, a modernist canon within the citadel of high culture produced the need for the autonomy of the art object and the institutionalizing of this autonomous in cultural terms. I think the first generation of artists after independence was certainly fully committed to the idea of the autonomy of art, and part of the Nehruvian project was to actually find an institutional place for the modern, and the modernist canon as developed by artistic practice itself was very squarely placed within the high culture of thus institutionalized within the Nehruvian period. This monolith, to my mind, needs to be broken, like all monoliths, for a renewed act of sovereignty itself. In other words, it's not merely a question of an artist having to wedge himself or herself into this canon in order to be able to find ways of practicing which are outside and therefore transgressive and therefore outside of the convention. I think that even for the very project which the Indian modern citizen has for himself or herself, which is the question of sovereignty, needs to be re-articulated in terms of in relationship to the immediate past, which seems to have in many ways been ruptured. However, definitionally, we have to see what, in fact, does an avant-garde require. I think that there's enough debate for us not to have to think this out completely from scratch. We would have to naturally mediate and reinterpret the issues for ourselves. But the historical avant-garde, at any rate, which I think, I hope, Andreas Huysen will be speaking about tomorrow in critical terms within the Euro-American context, to put it very, very notationally, there would be at least three requisites for actually defining what an historical avant-garde might be. One, an anti-institutionalism, including a questioning of the institutional autonomy of art, or of autonomous art as an institutional principle within bourgeois culture. Something that we did approximate to, I think, in the 50s and 60s in India. So one would think that that needs to be questioned. Two, a reconnection between art and life, and this would be one of the demands, as it were, of any avant-garde, in the same moment as the autonomy is questioned, the autonomy of art is questioned, there is an attempt to make a relationship with the living situation, the living circumstance. And connected with that is the third, which is integration of high and low culture. Now, at various points in 20th century Indian art, this has been attempted. It was attempted very importantly in Shantiniketan from the 20s until the 40s. It was attempted in a different way by the progressives, who, while they wanted to establish an autonomy for the artist, were also pitching themselves into a question of language, which inevitably brought up the question of high and low culture. It was reattempted by Group 1890 in 1963, with Swaminathan as the main ideologue for that, in a different set of ways. And here I can't go into each, I suppose that would require another kind of a presentation. And I think that subsequently the two movements or groups and movements that I've mentioned, the Place for People in early 80s and the Radical Artists in the mid 80s, each one would have addressed themselves in some form or the other to these questions. Now, whether we would like then to designate them as having constituted an avant-garde is the question that I want to leave open. And perhaps we don't want to use the word, perhaps we want to use another word. We have never in our discourse actually used the word avant-garde. We have always used the word progressive or radical. And I'm wondering whether those two words are the only words we want to use? Do we wish to replace them? And is the term avant-garde useful for us? We have to work with what I would suggest, however, is whether that this question perhaps cannot be answered frontally. Shall we use the word or shall we not? we have to actually begin to define the practice and then perhaps elicit from that practice the possibility of a category emerging from it. What seems clear to me in any case is that we have to work with a poetics of displacement where the fragment provides a part for whole significance. The fragment may be split off in a volatile movement, that is an ideological disengagement from the hegemonic culture, or on the other hand, it may be an element that was never integrated and which then further devolves to withstand assimilation. It could be, for example, the place of the feminine, which then takes on a very consciously feminist position. Consider two kinds of art activity or art practice, and I take these two examples also because, amongst other examples, it would be useful to take because you've seen slides of these two artists yesterday. Take the position of Nalini Malani, and the way she has worked out the devolution of subjectivity and language to a point of disintegration, even a measured degeneracy. And I think that the example that she provided yesterday, or the very motif, the very theme of the mutant, is in fact a biological, a linguistic, and an existential working out of the principle of devolution of the body and of existence. She gestures towards the world, but it is her subjectivity that fills up the world vacuum. Such an anti-aesthetic coincides with the refusal to concede a sane social space in which meaning can be reconstituted even momentarily. The tattered fabric of the world is the fragment for the tragic, as in the mutant series. It is also a masquerade on Nalini's part to actually pose the notion of the mutant as the way in which she can deal with the world. As against this state of dissolution and entropy, Vivan's anarchic gestures stand counterpointed by formal structures in the world. And I'm deliberately, as you can see, juxtaposing two unlikely terms, anarchic gestures and formal structures in the world. Each part is inscribed with a notation that assumes the possibility of reconfiguring the world. The art object or installation resonating in the public space and making possible the recovery of social meanings. I think in a way when Pushpa was suggesting that there is something like a more marginal art practice which women engage in, apart from how it might fit into another kind of universal which feminism has established, there was some gesture towards this question which of the way the devolution of the body in Nalini's case, which refuses or which constantly questions and refuses to allow a public space to emerge, and in the case of Vivan, very much from, I think, very correctly from the position of the way a male artist can take on art history in a certain way, would position himself not only within art history in a certain way, but in the public space in another way. But one mustn't press these too far. I think this is just notational, and then the argument would have to complicate this very statement. The third part of the presentation is titled "The Object Displaced and Replaced in an Installation." The intervention of the contemporary artist tends to be more about a reinscription of the body, a resurrected presence in the dismantled condition of self that we have been speaking about. It is evident not only in visual art practice, it is evident in, for instance, very appropriately, in the form of dance. And I think all of you would be familiar with Chandralekha's work. And I think Chandralekha in the modern times for us has been able to do that. Two, the sensuousness of most non-Western art as against the remote signs thrown out by Western artists within an installation form has been a matter of delighted comment as well as intellectual embarrassment for Indians. It's a question of always having posed the hot and cold issue. The third world produces from the gut hot art, and that there is a kind of distancing, a kind of ability to detach the self from the art object, which comes from a long history of modernism itself in the West, which is both an, I think that the debate has to be slightly more, or the engagement has to be slightly more than saying, this is where we are, we speak from, we have still a raw existential potential which has been coded in art historical terms for the Western artist. And therefore, our best bet is on one kind of art rather than another. I think that needs to be questioned. And we neither need to be excited about this nor embarrassed. I think we just have to examine the modes in which an Indian artist would be inscribing himself or herself within a new form, like an installation form for us, new for us. The object of art and the installation as a theatric mise-en-scène is quite differently structured in societies that have traditions of magic, of fetishism, and ritual, including elaborate artisanal and performance skills. And I think that the moment we begin to consider this form of articulating objects in space, we would have to answer these questions so that it would not only be a question of taking on another kind of spatial relationship between objects because that defies commodification. It would also have to immediately refer itself to another kind of reification, which takes place through fetishism, through magic, through fetishism, through ritual practice, so that we would be addressing simultaneously two sets of problems, the commodification of the market on the one hand, and the long tradition of fetishizing. Installations in these countries, and I'm now speaking not only of India, but I think it would be relevant for Asia, for Africa, for Latin America possibly, although Latin America has had a longer history of this kind of a project. The installation form, and I'm using the word little more generally at the moment, not site-specific installation only, but objects placed in relationship to each other in a way that you have to actually engage with them in terms of a body itinerary between them, and therefore that space, even if it's a gallery space, is changed by the very nature of that positioning of the object within it. In our cases, and I'm referring now, as I said, to more than India, to Asia and Africa at least, the relationship to material, which is quite different from their northern uses or from their western uses. We must remember that the material is still connected with artisanal practice, as I just said above, with handcraft. The artists have skills. There are artisans in between or in transitional states within a village and urban market economy who still have traditional skills. There's a question of skill as paid labor and the problem of exploitation of indigenous practices therefrom. And there's a question of authenticity, not of being within tradition, but of the material conditions of practice, and of a language that transcends these conditions, even the condition or even the way the question of authenticity has been posed until now. I think that the Shantiniketan artists already in the 20s had addressed this question. And Subramaniam and Ghulam Sheikh tried to work this question out through actual acts of pedagogy in Baroda. That they were actually addressing these questions even outside of the question of installation and postmodernism, or avant-garde art and postmodernism. They were addressing these questions squarely in terms of art practice in general. The meaning of an installation has to be seen in at least three overlapping senses for our context. Ritual, it overlaps with ritual and fetish presentations, ritual presentations. It has to have some mode of being able to be read semiotically, and it is more likely than not, has to be understood in its metonymic extension. Note that this is in connection, observation in connection with the fact that Indian art by and large has been heavily metaphoric. And the metaphor has dominated to such an extent that there is an urgent need, to my mind, to decathect the self from that object, the art object, to ease the processes of condensation, to introduce the poetics and politics of displacement. And that is the sense in which I'm using the term metonymic here. The object in an Indian or Asian artist's installation stands then in an in-between stage of use and exchange value. In a situation of incomplete modernization and market economy, there's also something like a half-baked or half-realized commodification. Older forms of fetishism survive with the new forms of reification in the consumer economies. The object should be beheld and grasped as such, with this double edge or the double face to it. The object, I'm deliberately, as you can see, neither calling it painting nor sculpture, I'm calling it the object, you could say the art object, installed within such a context is neither fully functional, nor sacred, nor entirely part of the market. There's reference to all three aspects at once, and of course to the fourth aspect, the making of art with its own parameters, stretched between art historical context and formal autonomy, which is the context in which an artist naturally will think and function. The discourse, the analysis, or the extrapolation theoretically can be outside of it, but most artists will naturally place themselves within the parameters within which they'll work will be art history and the formal question of formal autonomy, and that will be then placed within other contexts with more or less conscious intervention on the part of each artist. This in-betweenness gives the object in an installation in India the quality of the object. It gives the object a liminal presence and makes the space liminal. Now, this may be the case with any kind of any kind of configuration of this kind, which I'm calling an installation. But I would suggest that in cultures like ours, the question of liminality has perhaps another meaning, because the rest of the space is, as it were, already overcrowded by cultural artifacts to an extent that the making of a liminal space, which might be taken for granted already in a gallery space, but the actual intervention to make that liminal space is an act that would have a different, would be charged with a different kind of commitment, perhaps, for an artist in our kinds of cultures. Apropos the liminal, societies like ours, there's an interest from a historical and anthropological position to open out the sacred, to open out the self-incorporated secret with which objects in the world and in art are imbued, to open these out into process and materiality. This social science methodology of prizing open the sacred, for instance, can be seen as analogous to avant-garde art practice we have been speaking about. Now, this is a question which, in fact, a social scientist, in fact, an anthropologist, would answer with much greater precision. And Veena Das, for example, might very well actually say that it is not a question of opening out the sacred, that, in fact, one is doing many more things to the sacred which need to be recuperated. And I think most artists would tend to take that position. I'm wanting to actually go against the grain a little and suggest that at this juncture, which I call, in fact, the disjuncture in our political and cultural life, that it is a question of, to my mind, opening out the sacred, to actually also open out the secret of the self into process in order to be able to make a proposition relevant to the historical moment. Consider how the subalternist historians and social scientists, in their social theory and in their social action, particularly and also via feminism, create an insistently critical function of breaking down the paradigm, the category, the object, of replacing contemplation, which is the mode of receiving modern art, with the mode of analysis, which is the way one apprehends the historical avant-garde. There is an open interest in primitive materialism, primitive in quotes, and tribal cosmologies, especially with the way these have come to the fore in questions of the indigenous people in Australia and also the Americas, and most certainly in Africa as it begins to become reflexive about its own cultural heritage. The counter taboo against any interference on the part of the metropolitan artist into the world of tribal and the tribal and contemporary tribal artists was based on one kind of an ethic, epitomized perhaps by Levi-Strauss. It has been broken to the extent that interaction between so-called closed and open communities is taken as inevitable in the present electronic age. Every space has been invaded or will be shortly. A new ethics of reciprocity has to be devised, which is equally wary of ethnographic sentiment for conservation, art historical desire for a traditional aesthetic, and national appropriation, and imperialist robbery and artistic masquerade on behalf of the people by metropolitan and certainly Western artists. A difficult situation indeed, far more difficult than that indicated by the debate around the Museum of Modern Art Primitivist Show in New York and the questions it raised about primitive sources and modernist art practice. Here is an ethics of identity that requires, as it were, a devalorization of the self or of subjective indulgences in an act of living solidarity with contemporary people in the social order, which includes various degrees of modernization from the metropolitan to peasant societies to tribal communities. And I think we should remember here and pay homage to the fact that Swaminathan was very advanced in his thinking on this question. I've been an antagonist with Swaminathan on many of these issues and polemically engaged with him. But now it seems to me that he was actually raising these questions, taking risks and making mistakes, but raising these questions nevertheless within the Indian context. Other options for an Indian Asian artist wanting to work in this maneuver their way, negotiate, I don't like the word negotiate, no maneuver, to find their place within this complicated field. There could be other kinds of options that are at work. I think they are at work, and I can say that from having seen a certain amount of Asian and African art. I've had the privilege of seeing quite a number of Asian artists in a Biennale of Asian Art in Australia, and more recently in Johannesburg, and Colin would probably come in and in his own presentation to either endorse or critique or to extend some of these issues. There is a positioning, I think, in our cultures at the moment between the questions of a contemplative aesthetic that I was speaking out above, based on a reattribution of the secret stroke or secret and sacred in the heart of a secular descent. And I think that I might again refer to the way that Veena Das would handle the question of the sacred and insist that in fact the desacralizing necessities of modern life have to be interrogated as much as the sacred as it resides in or as the tradition is endowed with. And I think in a different way Rustam Barucha has tried to question it in his discourse. This, I would say, is to be perhaps put, or is put, by an artist in our situation, face to face with a loosening of iconic severities, a deliberate destruction of classicism, both civilizational and modern. So I think both positions would probably be attempted at the same time, not necessarily by the same artist, but artists working very close to each other in juxtaposition of each other. History of national liberation movements or nationalist histories and their ironic about-face and sometimes farcical inversions are something that an artist, as every member of the intelligentsia or every citizen perhaps, has to address, would be also the part of the kind of responsibility that an artist would have to deal with. Face-to-face with that would be strategies of survival, which would include a relay of memory and blood of heroism and reversals. It would have to be able to deal with that landscape of debris. And I was very conscious of that, of course, when I went to South Africa. The diasporic imagination that questions imperialism as well as the national culture is part of our debate already. For a long time, the diaspora was out there fending for itself, the Indian Asian diaspora in Europe, in England and America, was obviously, we considered, not our business. It was not our it didn't trouble us. I think that position is not going to be feasible anymore, partly because most of us relate to the world very differently. The international is reconstituted in a different sort of way. And also because by and by we will find that all our articulations are in actual fact mediated by the diaspora intelligentsia. So that willy-nilly we'd have to deal with this issue. We'd have to deal with the fact that Gayatri Spivak or Homi Bhabha represent the Asian identity to the United States. And so that to that extent we have to engage with the question of the diasporic reinterpretation of the third world within the totality of the three world configuration. At the same time, it would perhaps be more than theirs, our responsibility to deconstruct the capitalist myth in the actual locations in the East, within what is now in a surreal manner, the global village, as it had been hypothesized by McLuhan. I think that this is perhaps not our experience as much as some of the Asian countries. I think the Thai or the Filipinos would have to actually deal with how capitalist myths are worked out on their ground. In fact, they are the ones on whose ground the last, or the not the last, unfortunately, the late capitalist myths are worked out, and to that extent, they would have to deal with it in terms of their own cultural practice. And I think that there are artists in Asia who are doing it. Certainly artists in Philippines seem to be doing it, in Thailand and Korea. I've already spoken of the fact that there are new subjectivities being introduced in an interventionist way by feminist art practice. To that, I would like to add that there is, deriving perhaps from that kind of feminist intervention, a hermeneutic of the historical avant-garde possible in our culture as well. Now, I want to... It was a light flash to say I've finished my time. I don't know how long I'll take. I'll take another few minutes. I was supposed to have yeah, but I didn't see it. I'll just take another, I think, 5 minutes. I just want to end with, in a way that links up, hopefully, with some of the discussions which may come up in the rest of today and tomorrow. I want to suggest that if there is a feasibility and a use in adopting the word avant-garde for the Indian cultural practice today, it would inevitably have somewhere to do with the theorizing on the historical avant-garde in the Euro-American context. And there is a continual revival of that debate in particularly in the American context. Through important art historians and through a journal like October. There's a recent article of Hal Foster's that criticizes the one of the major theorists of the avant-garde, Peter Berger, who has the book called The Theory of the Avant-Garde, for too sectarian a position on the 1920s avant-garde, the commitment to the historical avant-garde in the 20s, particularly to the revolutionary moment of avant-garde in the Soviet Union, but also broadly to the movements of Dada and Surrealism, the avant-garde in Germany, can be extended to speak about what Foster is criticizing or critiquing is that this is too sectarian in a way that that it should be or it has to be extended to speak about the avant-garde initiatives in the non-Western world, or rather, sorry, he's suggesting that it should be possible to speak about the avant-garde in the later 60s and until today, that he would like to open up the question, that not to suggest that it would be counterproductive as well as, in fact, self-defeating for any notion of the avant-garde to see itself fixed at any given point. That the very nature of the avant-garde, of course, is that it continues to break new ground. Now, the argument that Hal Foster is making vis-a-vis contemporary practice today in the West can be further extended for our purposes to suggest that the initiatives in the non-Western world, especially at present Africa and the Asia-Pacific, should be able to both engage and distance itself from the notion of a Western avant-garde per se, whether of the 20s or the 60s, that one should be able to engage with it without being overburdened by the terms of reference of that avant-garde. The Asian avant-garde would set itself against an endemic vanguardism of Western societies, perhaps. That is to say, it would treat the avant-garde principles itself as an institutionalized phenomenon, in that the museum, the gallery, the critical apparatus, the curators, the media have an assimilative capacity for far exceeding the initiatives of the artists, such as, for example, Duchamp on the one hand, Malevich or Rodchenko on the other. So that we are faced with the fact, the Western artist is faced with the fact, we even more than them, faced with the fact that there's an endemic vanguardism in the West, that we would have to deal with that. But not by disengaging ourselves is my proposition, that we would have to engage with it and see what the problem is in our terms. An artist like Joseph Beuys, who was of no great interest to artists, to Indian artists until recently, until the new generation of artists, that is, artists who have emerged in the 80s do engage with the issues Joseph Beuys raised. And perhaps Joseph Beuys emerges less frozen than some of the 1960s avant-garde, the minimalist particularly. I think that is why Beuys interests people more than, for instance, Donald Judd will or Carl Andre will. But even Joseph Beuys, of course, presents a big problem. He emerges less frozen for good reason, that he's so much more ironical and elusive. But the Beuys phenomena is certainly a living and now posthumous myth. And like all myths, it produces a stranglehold on the contemporary. And I think that Kiefer would do the same. And I would like to suggest that these are the two artists, in fact, that interest the younger generation of artists, Kiefer and Beuys. The paradox of this phenomenon, that is, the Western avant-garde phenomenon, for the Asian artist is monumental. The operations in history have a kind of permanent reverberation, and the Asian Indian artist must make at least two moves simultaneously. One, to dismantle hegemonic features of a national culture itself, and two, to dismantle as well the burdensome heritage of Western art, including its radicalism. This can scarcely be done at a conceptual or ideological level alone. It has to be done in terms of language and material and gesture, such that the object of art or its installation will appear like so much transgressive energy. Not that this energy is to be left swirling around. The idea of the classical is present in these cultures in large measure, and the recoding of the raw material of self and the world requires adequate formal means. The acts of desublimation are that much more complex in these cultures, based as they are on a civilizational sublimation through centuries. I have an image in mind, and it's an image from cinema. If the aesthetic of modernism pointed in one direction and the political or historical avant-garde in another, the Asian in African Indian artist wanders off possibly in a third direction. That is where the track may lie, in some other direction. And I think these are notes towards an exploration of that direction. Thank you.
You talked about this open and closed community and about the national appropriation and about the cultural invasion by the imperialists. Now, do you think that by closing down the society like the way China did or Russia did, was it helpful, or is there any other way out? Gandhian view of the self-reliance, that you cut off yourself in certain ways from the other world.
Yeah, Bhupen, that's a dreadful question to ask. I mean, you're asking, opposing a question in retrospect, whether the closed so society of the socialist world was possibly not only the reality but also a good idea, that has been so heavily critiqued that I think that we can't go back to the debate in that way. You are posing a third proposition that was there in our own terms at the beginning of the century or in the middle of the century, another kind of option that Gandhi had presented, which or proposed of Indian Swaraj onwards. I am not in a position to answer that question because these have become so now so drastically hypothetical questions that the fact that India took a certain route within its own national formation and its relationship to the world makes it almost not a question only of impossible but possibly now futile to ask the question. But I would hope that somebody else actually can take up the question and that we make a relay. Maybe I can come back to it in a moment. I don't feel prepared to answer the question in those terms, at any rate.
Can I ask a question? Taking up, I didn't quite. There was a sentence quite early on in your talk where you actually referred to Bhupen as having for 30 years broken down the two deterministic relation between. And then I didn't quite follow what the categories were, and I felt they needed to elaborate. I didn't. Can you just say a little bit?
Yes, I have said history, sovereignty, and subjectivity as a subject.
There's two abstract words.
And a shorthand with possible relationships. One could also work it, of course, after this, for my purpose, after this, for my strategy, after this, rework this in terms of the actual practice. I mean, this is a, I think, valid possibility.
But could you just say a little?
But I would like to suggest that why I suggested Bhupen might have been doing this is that the historical task Bhupen never took on, I mean, not of Indian artists, took on a historical task, it might not have been necessarily. Figured as such in the work, but their own sense of being, their positioning as an artist identity within the cultural context might have been that. Bhupen never even took on that historical task of actually presenting an identity which in some way signals towards the historical position in which he is placed, which is post-independent national culture. That is one. And to that was connected the second word, which is sovereignty, the idea of sovereignty as inscribed within a historical consciousness. Now, there's also a sovereignty which, of course, is inscribed within an existential context. And I think that he would have put a wedge between the idea of a historical notion of sovereignty and placed it in relationship to the subject. But that subjectivity would be dealt with in terms very different from the existentialist terms, which were the actual matrix out of which a great deal of modern Indian art came in literature and the visual arts. And I think that he would be putting a wedge in that kind of relationship of sovereignty and subjectivity as well, and more so perhaps in the more recent work.
Sorry, can I come back? Isn't there a paradox that he was talking about the hybrid, the half westernized nature of the nation? In a way, I mean, I think he was conscious of that. Of speaking
of the middle class, certainly, and therefore a large component of the nation.
Yes, mm-hmm. I mean, there was a sort of, he wasn't without a certain position.
Yes. Okay. I can see the point. That in fact, in the way that he was actually putting himself more openly than most other artists in the culture of the middle class. And designating that culture as hybrid, he was actually making an intervention. I would just say that.
In that context, isn't Bhupen's statement strange about talking about Swadeshi? Bhupen, I mean, what did you have in mind?
No, I just asked a question.
because the way she had positioned, I think I was very much concerned with the closed society. Like in India, if we go backward, the whole Rajput art and all these things developed because it was a closed society. And that closed society developed a certain kind of art. So that was my question,
so
whether at present that closed society can bring up any culture or any art.
So you wondered whether something like that could happen again.
But it did not happen in case of China.
Right.
And even in Soviet Union.
Right.
So I just wondered.
Yeah.
Well, what he's asking is that, but that contradiction we've known about. It's a generative contradiction. He has an ethical or a kind of ethical commitment or an engagement with Gandhi, but in actual fact functions from a cultural situation which is more immediately contemporary to himself. But I think this would be true of so many of us, that it is, we should have to see it as a generative relationship, where you have, an ideology has an utopian potential with which you continue to engage, at the same time having to tackle the contemporary.
Yes.
One of the things that troubles me as far as the general public is concerned is the present state of belief that if you do not understand the painting or if you do not understand the poem, it must be a great poem and a great and then if the person is, let us say, financially or in other situations quite strong, they want, if you give them a painting which can be understood, their response very, very often is, no, that's not what I had in mind. I want a modern painting which I will not understand and my visitors won't understand either. That means they will admire it and respect. And if that happens, I don't know how to deal with it. Both in the case of poetry, if you understand the poem, it can't be good. So what does one do? How does one respond?
I don't know how to respond there, but there is a, you're looking at it from the point of view of consumption. The